So thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you for asking me to speak. It's a real delight to be able to speak at the Women's Congress. So, this talk is dedicated to those who've pioneered team-based right livelihood. And particularly to people who've worked in the team-based right livelihoods at the LBC, because we have a strong tradition here of team-based right livelihood businesses. So it's quite a mouthful, team-based right livelihood business, and it means a group of women, well, women or men, working together to run a business as Buddhists, practicing together to raise money. So they started off to raise money to start off centres and to fund centres. And as Shiva was saying, part of that, the point of that, was for people to have a way to earn enough money to live. So we're not waged, we don't have a wage, but we are supported, we get enough money to live on. And enough support to go on retreats, and a little bit extra for sort of pocket money. So when I started thinking about this talk, I just, the evening before, I'd heard somebody reading a poem, and it's a poem she'd written, and it was, she'd done a lot of research into what's happening in North Korea, where there are, they sound like concentration camps, really, prison camps with appalling conditions. So that was very much, you know, that had happened the evening before, that was very much in my awareness. And I was thinking about how people can do that, how people can work in a place like that and be part of a structure like that that treats people in such inhumane ways. And what often happens to me when I hear about things like that is I go into horrified anxiety. It's just too awful, I don't want to think about it. Or sometimes into kind of almost guilt that I live in, you know, a comfortable, affluent, safe society. And, you know, I don't have any, you know, I can practice as a Buddhist freely, I can walk down the street safely, I can travel across the country safely. And I was thinking about, you know, concentration camps in Nazi Germany as well, and I don't know, I haven't read a great deal about that, but the film, I don't know if you know, The Boy in Striped Pyjamas, I thought was quite a good film in that it did give a sense of what it might be like for people involved in running those sort of camps. And I wanted to read you a quote, which I also found. When I read this, I thought it showed a real kind of empathy. I mean, I don't want to in any way justify what people have do in those situations, but I think this quote shows the author has a certain empathy with how you could end up being in that position, which I find very touching in a way. So this is from a Neil Gaiman book. Yeah, and it's a complex story about America and gods and all sorts of things, but this bit stood out to me. There are stories that are true, in which each individual's tale is unique and tragic. And the worst of the tragedy is that we have heard it before, and we cannot allow ourselves to feel it too deeply. We build a shell around it like an oyster dealing with a painful particle of grit, coating it with smooth pearl layers in order to cope. This is how we walk and talk and function day in, day out, immune to others' pain and loss. If it were to touch us, it would cripple us or make sense of us. But for the most part, it doesn't touch us. We cannot allow it in. Tonight, as you eat, reflect if you can. There are children starving in the world, starving in numbers larger than the mind can easily hold. Up in the big numbers, where an error of a million here, a million there, can be forgiven. It may be uncomfortable for you to reflect upon this, or it may not, but still you will eat. There are accounts which, if we open our hearts to them, would cut us too deeply. Look, here is a good man, good by his own lights and the lights of his friends. He is faithful and true to his wife. He adores and lavishes attention on his little children. He cares about his country. He does his job punctiliously as he can. So efficiently and good-naturedly, he exterminates Jews. He appreciates the music that plays in the background to pacify them. He advises the Jews not to forget their identification numbers as they go into the showers. Many people, he tells them, forget their numbers and take the wrong clothes when they come out of the showers. This calms the Jews. There will be life, they assure themselves, after the showers. And they are wrong. Our man supervises the detail, taking the bodies to the ovens. And if there is anything he feels bad about, it is that he still allows the gassing of vermin to affect him. Were he a truly good man, he knows, he would feel nothing but joy as the earth is cleansed of its pests. Leave him, he cuts too deeply. He is too close to us and it hurts. Yeah, so I think the point of me reading that is that we all have, as human beings, potential, given horrendous circumstances and horrendous conditioning, to behave in unimaginably awful ways. And we all have the potential for developing far beyond anything we could imagine. And I believe that is what it is to be human. It's not that we're bad or particularly good. It's that we're human. And we don't really know what we're capable of until we're in extreme circumstances. So I had a bit of a shock this week. And, you know, when somebody does something that you didn't expect and you really are shocked and upset and it's the last thing you would have wanted them to do to you, well, it's just interesting to watch what one's response is. You know, is one's response to be metaphor? Actually, my response to this person is I want to go and give him a bit of a slap. Well, worse, actually, worse than that. I want to tell him what I think of him, and it's not very nice. But, you know, it's important to know that about oneself. It's important to be honest and to recognise that. I'm not going to do that. At least I don't think I'm going to hit him or anything. But, you know, just to notice how strong that response is when we don't get what we want, when we don't hear what we want. And for me, I think that is an indication of, you know, I know I could do terrible things if I was in difficult conditions, and I don't really know how badly I could behave. because I'm so lucky that I'm not in those conditions. I've had very good conditions, and I continue to be in very good conditions. So I feel a lot of gratitude for my circumstances, and particularly for never having, you know, I've never had to work in a job that I don't feel comfortable working in. I've never had to do work that, you know, I have to kind of shut my eyes to the consequences of what I'm doing, or justify to myself that it's worth doing something I'm not happy doing. Yeah. So I trained as a dietitian and qualified in about 1985. I never had a permanent job as a dietitian. I did lots of temporary jobs. And after a few years, I gave up because I realised that I didn't like working in hospitals. And after a while, I retrained as an early years teacher. And I worked for 7 years full time in a nursery school in Poplar, actually. And then as a supply nursery school teacher, until about 4 years ago, well, 5 years ago, probably, more or less. I feel very fortunate, yeah, as I've just said, to have never had to do a job to get money that I didn't feel comfortable doing. So, when we start to meditate and become more aware and develop more metta, immediately, really, the area of ethics comes into our awareness. So work takes up, for a lot of us, a lot of our time. Most of our waking life is taken up with work for a lot of us. And as we become more aware, we begin to notice more subtleties about how we feel about the work that we do. Whether we feel sometimes frustrated or bored, can't bear it, or we love it. We feel potent, perhaps, and competent. Sense of contribution to society. And it gets harder to carry on behaving in unhelpful, habitual ways. We start to become aware of how much or how little responsibility for ourselves and our actions, emotions and thoughts we take. We start to make more conscious choices and be aware of the consequences. So as this all unfolds, quite naturally, the consequence of our developing more awareness and metta is that we may actually find that we can't carry on in the same way. We may find that we want to change the way we approach work or the job that we're doing. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about my working life, and then talk a bit about the work that I'm doing now and how I see it very much as my Buddhist practice. Yeah. So when I was a full-time nursery teacher during that period, I started coming along to the centre to meditate. And at that point, I'd been working in the school for about 5.5 years or so. And I worked, there was five of us in the team that I worked with. So that was one other teacher and then three nursery nurses. And I'd had quite a tricky time with some of the teachers that I'd worked with, found it quite difficult to work well with them, had various problems. And about this time, when I came along to the centre, I was having difficulty with one of the nursery nurses, and I actually complained to the head teacher about her. And Then the next thing that happened was that the team complained about me. And it was a complete shock to me. I just thought that I was unlucky that I'd worked with some difficult people. And yeah, I was very embarrassed and ashamed when it was pointed out to me that I was difficult to work with. And I knew some order members here by that point, and I asked for some help and had some good advice about how to move forward. And so I apologised to the team, and the order member I talked to said, why don't you try every day offering to do something, you know, to reach out to someone in the team, sort of offer to make someone a cup of tea or ask them how their weekend's been, or offer to help, go out of your way to help them to do something, they've got to do some task. So a few months later I did leave the school. I wanted to study art and do supply teaching to support myself. But by the time I left, I was in good connection with the people that I worked with, and in good connection with the head teacher as well. So it felt like, well, I had a sense of how you can turn a situation around and make it from a very difficult situation into a very positive situation. So I did supply teaching for quite a long time, quite a few years, and I really felt I could throw myself into it wholeheartedly. I liked very much working in nursery schools. It's a lovely environment, generally happy environment to work in. And as a supply teacher with quite a bit of experience of that situation, I felt like I had a lot to give, and it's just lovely working with the children in the nursery schools. Particularly in this borough, some very good nursery schools. So then I got ordained, became an order member in this movement, and decided that I wanted to change the way I earned my living. And so for a year I was trying to retrain and establish myself in a different line of work. And I found that was quite a difficult time, and I wasn't really earning enough money. And I got into some difficulties around money, which have taken a long time to sort out the ramifications of that. But I did go back to supply teaching, and because I knew I could earn my living that way. And then after a few years I realised that that wasn't working quite so well for me, and I wanted to have a more integrated life and actually work with Buddhists. I was in sort of exploring various possibilities, various places that I might be able to work, a retreat centre and Buddha Field and so on. And then Claudine, who's just got ordained and is now a Bayanandi, she called a meeting of people interested in working together with Buddhists, and a wide range of people came. And we discussed various ideas, and then at the end of the evening, she and I had the same idea of a charity shop, and we started talking about it, and very quickly, having met together a few times, it was clear that we were both very much moving in the same direction with our ideas. And she had the experience of finance. She'd worked in the city, and a very good business head, and I got the experience of being in the movement, practicing in the movement for quite a long time, and then being ordained. And we both really believed, I think, that team-based right livelihood could work well. And it was just at the time when the cafe, the Lardo, that was called the Wild Cherry, and that was a team of women. For a long time, that was a team of Buddhist women working together in a team-based right livelihood business, and it had been very potent, I think. A lot of women had worked there and then got ordained from there. And there was also the health food shop, which is where we are now. And the Cherry had gone through a period of change and then was closed. The health food shop closed, and there'd been a little cafe as well, which changed to non-Buddhist team. And so, it was a very particular time, and it was really sad that those businesses were no longer running. But we were confident that it could still work. We just needed to find the right thing, and we thought that charity shop was the right thing that would, work as a team-based right livelihood business. So we were motivated by a desire to raise money for the centre. We wanted it to run a team-based right livelihood business, but it had to be effective and it had to make money for the centre. And as I say, she had the experience to do that because she was really good with figures and has a very good business head. And if you know her, she's very dynamic and there's kind of no messing. If she's going to do something, she's really going to do it. So we were fully up for taking responsibility for it, and both of us knew that we were going to be committed. We weren't going to give up if it didn't work in 6 months. And to our surprise, very, very quickly, it was successful and it was making profit. So that's meant that we've been able to expand the team to four of us. And we have made an awful lot of money for the centre. It's been really significant, I think, for the centre that we've been so successful and continue to be successful. So we start the day with the refuges and precepts together and a cup of tea or coffee, of course. Yeah, so we start with refuges and precepts and we check in. And usually at the end of the day, we do rejoicing in each other's merits. So we just spend a bit of time saying what we've appreciated about each of us during the day and about ourselves. We don't open the shop. We get into work at 10. We don't open the shop till 12 through the week. And then on Saturday, we open a bit earlier. So that gives us 2 hours in the week, in the mornings. And during those 2 hours, sometimes we're sorting and pricing stuff, because there's a lot of sorting and pricing to do and taking the stuff out of bags. But we also study once a week. So Subhadramati, who some of you all know, leads study for us, and Jambala as well. And then one morning we have a business meeting. We have once a year two planning days, beginning of the year two planning days, which are really great days when we review the year and plan for the next year. And we also have a little retreat, sort of a couple of nights we go away and we share our stories, really, our life stories, tell each other about our lives, as well as having very nice tea out in a tea shop somewhere, and a nice walk and things like that. We have training days as well, so probably about 3 days during the year we ask someone to come and give us a bit of training. So we've had compassionate communication with Vajraganta, and we've had some Myers-Briggs input and so on. So the benefits for me of working at Lama's Pyjamas is that life is much simpler. So I live in a community in Approach Road, very close to here with other Buddhist women, including Shibha. And I don't have to commute more than 5 minutes to work. Everything I do is in this little area, really. And I'm just in very supportive conditions for practicing the Dharma around Buddhists all the day and at home. My finances are very simple. I just get paid support and then the money goes. It's quite a nice thing to think that money comes to me for support and it goes back to the centre. So it's like this little circle goes round. And I have enough money for my needs. All my basic needs are covered and a little bit extra. I go on the retreats. You know, it's quite a generous retreat allowance. We're encouraged to go on retreats. So a very simple life. When I want to go more into the area of awareness. So we, in the mornings, sometimes, once a week, we have a look at a little bit of study together. So this is different from what we do with Subhadra Dramati. This is something just for our team. And we're looking at this book, which I expect you probably have seen, Life with Full Attention. And I'm going to use his structure for the rest of the talk. So he covers particular areas of awareness. And daily life practice, body, feelings, mind, the teachings of the Buddha, the environment, especially nature and art, people and insight. So those are the areas that I'm going to mention. So by practicing awareness, what I mean is the process by which he encourages in his book, by which we become more aware of how we are and how we behave, feel and think, noticing if it's helpful or causes pain to ourselves and others, and seeing if we can hold that, seeing if we can hold that with kindness. And seeing how we can change things so that we can encourage ourselves to do the things which have a positive consequence more often, and try to stop doing the things which cause us and others suffering. So, daily life practice. So, one of the big areas for me at work in terms of daily life practice is trying to keep things in order. So in the shop, it's a very busy shop, it's very full on. You never quite know when donations are going to come in and how many donations are going to come in at any time. So sometimes it can feel like we are swamped in bags and stuff. And when you just move enough bags away somewhere from the table so that you can get round the table, so that you can get a bag to unpack it to get things out, somebody will come with a carload and you just have to deal with it, you know. And we've got quite small, quite limited space. So we've got a nice spacious shop, and then out the back we've got a little room with a big table. We've got two pens, and at the moment they're always full. And then we've usually got bags scattered around the floor that we can't fit into the pen. And then we've got a little space out the back before we've got our shed. And our shed is our sort of clear space where we can sit down and have a cup of tea or have our business meeting or whatever. We try to keep it free of bags, but sometimes it's the overflow space as well. There's lots of little odds and ends in our back stock room that we need because, you know, we have all sorts of items coming into the shop, and you never quite know what you need. So we need all sorts of things like shoe cleaner and different cleaning fluids and brushes and different ranges of tags to deal to price the different sorts of items. And so we've got all this stuff on shelves, and then we've got on our table the things that we need all the time, like the pricing gun and so on. And very easily it can just get absolutely chaotic. And we have such varied things that you're often getting things out of the bag and thinking, well, I need to look that up because I don't even know what that is, you know. So you put that to one side, and then you think, oh, this is a nice jumper. Oh, actually, I don't think I might. Oh, okay. I might want to try that on. So you put that aside, and then you pull something else out, and you think, I wonder if so-and-so would like that. So you put that somewhere. And it can just get completely out of hand. And I like chaos, and I like muddle and mess. And I think that can be quite challenging for the people that I work with. Because I will just get everything out, you know, and then kind of go, oh, now it's time for me to go on the till. And there's kind of stuff everywhere. And I think it drives my colleagues mad sometimes. So I have to really remember that, you know, I've got to keep things under control, because in 5 minutes, it's not just that in 5 minutes I might have to go on the till, but in that 5 minutes, somebody might arrive with a carload of stuff that I've got to find somewhere to put. And so I've got to really work at keeping things, you know, a bit contained and a bit ordered, so that I'm ready at a moment's notice to deal with whatever happens. And that's a real practice for me. It's not my natural way of doing things. I just want to spread everything around the place and then gradually work through it and make order. It's similar at the till. The till also has to be, often you're pricing at the till, but you know, you have to keep it in some kind of order, because it, again, it can just get chaotic at the till. So it's sort of remembering that what I do is going to affect somebody in a very direct, immediate sense. Trying to take other people into account. So the way we work is as a team. We don't have a manager. We rotate the jobs that a manager might do. So cashing up and making the daily plans, taking the minutes at meetings. It's all rotated. We take turns doing that sort of thing. And then we also have our particular areas that we are responsible for an overview of. And all our big decisions are made collectively. So no one person is going to tell any of us what to do. We have to be responsible for the effect of our actions on the others that we work with. And we try to support each other with this by trying to kindly communicate that. So trying to remind each other about the effects of leaving things in a mess or not putting things back in the right place and that kind of thing. And the Myers-Briggs training that we've had I found really helpful with this, because it's just helped me to understand that when I have a different way of seeing things or a different way of doing things, it is just that, it's just a different approach. And my way of doing things is no better or worse than anyone else's way. And to just try and understand that I like doing it this way, but somebody else might like doing it that way. And it doesn't mean either of us is right or wrong. It's just a difference. And I find it really helps if I can try and remember that. The next area is body. So this is quite a working ground again for me at work. And my habit is to ignore my body So I've always been fairly healthy and fairly fit and not had many health problems. And I think I've got by just, just not really taking my body into account much. And I've been able to do that because of being fit. But at work, very easily, discomfort can build up in my back. I get backache. And over the years, with meditation and various physical practices, yoga and so on, slowly I've become a little bit more in my body, a little bit more aware of my body. At work I often get stuck in the same position. I'm doing sometimes repetitive actions, pricing things, or at the till, just sitting at the till, and that can, then my back can start aching. And then sometimes we also have to lift quite heavy stuff. And the steaming, there's a machine, a steamer machine thing we use to steam clothes, and it's quite heavy. And it's, again, you're doing the same sort of movement with this heavy object along this whole rail of clothes. But I'm learning gradually how to work with the backache, and if I stay in my body, aware of my body, and notice it building up, then it's very easy to deal with it and just remember, I need to move a bit because I'm getting stuck in the same position. And this seems a pretty crude level of working, but it does make a lot of difference, not just to how I am with the backache, but to my interactions with people, because I'm not very nice to be around when I've got backache. I'm able to engage in a more positive, kindly way with others if I'm looking after my back. And so that affects the team and the customers. And on a more subtle level, I can get stressed. I mean, it is a situation where it can feel a bit overwhelming at times. And if I get stressed and tense and anxious, that often I notice that in my body, the tension in my jaw or in my back and shoulders. And if I can notice that, then I'm not dominated by that. And I can stay more positive and friendly. So that takes me on to the next area, which is awareness of feelings. Because mostly how I notice how I'm feeling is through the body. So I notice I'm angry because my guts have tensed up and my jaw's tense. Or I know I'm scared because my chest is uncomfortable and tight and my heart rate has increased. I feel happy and I know it because I feel light and open in the body. I feel I'm bouncing along. So it's very helpful to work in a team. So there's a model for looking at team-based right livelihood. Team, task and individual. So the task is to raise money for the centre. And the team is obviously the group of people who are working in that business. And then there's the individual people that make up that team. So we want to run the shop efficiently and make as much money as possible. There's also the needs of the team. We want it to be a positive team. Particularly in the shop, that's significant because I think that's what makes the customers enjoy the shop and come back to the shop. So a lot of customers come in very regularly, keep coming back to the shop and really appreciate it and will say how much they love it. And I think they may not realise that part of the reason why it feels so good in the shop is because it's a positive atmosphere. The team, it's a lovely team to work in. We generally get on very well. And when we do, when we're not getting on well, we tackle it. You know, we kind of have to in that situation. So it's very positive. And I think that's a large part of why people like coming into the shop. So the team is really important, us getting on well. But also there's the needs of the individual. We want to, all of us want to work in that situation because we want to practice. We want to develop as Buddhists. We want to go deeper into our Buddhist practice. And it needs to work for us individually. If any of those things get out of balance, it's not going to be an effective situation. And it can be quite helpful to think of keeping those things in balance. So if we put too much emphasis on the needs of the individual, and people say, somebody might think that, well, I might think I need some help with my back, I get sore back, so I need osteopathy and I need Alexander technique lessons. And if I ask for money for those, and I'm given money for those, that's fine. But then somebody else might say, well, actually, I need some therapy. And you could very easily end up with a lot of the profits going to meet individuals' different needs, as it were. If the emphasis is too much on the team, you can spend all your time trying to work out team dynamics and get the team really functioning well. And then there's not enough time and energy to actually do the task and make money for the shop. If the emphasis is too much on the task and making money for the shop, you could end up with some very unhappy people, and you might end up with people just leaving because they're not enjoying the work. So we need to keep all those in balance. And I would say, certainly my experience is that we do pretty well with that. So I have to work quite hard at expressing how I'm feeling. We do support each other with this, but I think it's, you know, it can feel risky at times when you're feeling quite strong emotion. Quite hard to say, isn't it? It's quite hard to say, actually, I'm really frustrated and upset because you've repriced something and I thought my pricing was great. This can, you know, be a bit humiliating. But in a team, it really encourages you to do that, really, because you're working so close together. If you don't express these things and they kind of fester, it can very easily turn the atmosphere a bit sour. So working in a team is really supportive, and you can't really, it's like you're with people day after day, you can't really pretend for long without people knowing that something isn't okay. So I do find it very supportive for actually just, encouraging each other to have the courage to say what's going on, get it out in the open, and move on. Yeah, generally people are very supportive and encouraging when with each other when we do that. I also had a particular incident where I was working with a casual worker, and she pointed out to me that my anxiety was really having quite a strongly negative effect on her and a customer, which was not easy or pleasant to hear, but actually it's made a big difference to me, I think, and in taking responsibility for my anxiety. Yeah, and also with the customers, it's an interesting process because they come, you know, we have a lot of regulars, so people will be coming in day after day after day. So when I have uncomfortable interaction with somebody, or I find someone a bit difficult, they're going to be back the next day and the next day, so I can keep practicing. So again, actually, that's really supportive conditions, because I just have to deal with it. If I find someone tricky, you know, I have to find a way to engage with them that's more positive and more creative. And I notice how with a particular customer that I like, I notice those sort of inconsistencies. You know, a particular customer that I like will come in and they'll say something that's a bit irritating, and I'll just go, oh yeah, but I like her, she's at work. And then somebody else will come in who I'm not so keen on, who I find a bit difficult, and they'll say the same thing, and I'm like, really, you know, and find it very difficult to contain my frustration. And it's just really interesting to notice things like that and to think, oh, that's interesting. Somebody else said that the other day and I was fine with it, you know. So you really, it's like that thing being mirrored back a lot by the customers. Yeah, I notice how I smile, you know, and I'm really open and friendly when somebody walks in who I like. And then somebody else will walk in and I'm like, hello. You know, and it's just very clear sometimes that how partial one is. Yeah. And how if I'm tired or grumpy, it's much harder to be friendly and I get cross and things like that. It's all sort of obvious stuff, but I just think it is a particular situation where you're dealing with a lot of customers coming back and over again, that it brings these things into relief. A lot of our customers are very warm and appreciative and friendly, I have to say. Some of them are very touching, and sometimes the ones I find most difficult are the ones that are most touching, especially when, you know, I do something, you know, and I lose my patience with them or I get irritated, and then, you know, sometimes we apologise to people, and it can be so touching that when you do that, when you actually admit, oh, look, I'm sorry, I was unfair or I was irritated or whatever, people really respond. Yeah. It can be very lovely. So mind is the next area. At the moment, what I'm noticing at work is how quickly I tell myself, well, not even tell myself, but I know what somebody else is doing, thinking or feeling. Sometimes it's like I'm not even aware I'm thinking it, but I just know that when someone's irritated, they're irritated because of something that I've done and they don't like me. And when I can be aware of what I'm doing, that that's just a habit, I can challenge that for myself and realise that I don't know. It's just habitual thinking. And, you know, I can perhaps ask them what's going on. You know, you don't seem very happy, what is it? Is it anything to do with me? Usually it's nothing to do with me. And then, you know, I can manage it. It's quite easy to deal with once I see that it's not true, that they're not, you know, they're not irritated with me. And also it's good if they say, well, actually, it is you, because then at least you know what's going on, don't you? And you can ask them why and what's upset them. So that has quite big implications for me, because I can actually kind of create a situation where I don't get on with someone based on once they seem to be a bit irritated with me, and I can build up a whole picture of this person as someone who I don't get on with. So bearing the teachings in mind is the next area. So the Tibetan Wheel of Life, which some of you might know, is a very complicated image of concentric circles with all sorts of complicated pictures of this, that and the other. It's sometimes described as a mirror for ourselves. So when you look at this complicated picture, it's like looking in a mirror and seeing ourselves. Right in the middle of the Tibetan Wheel of Life, the axle, as it were. There's a pig, a cock and a snake, and they're chasing round after each other in a circle, holding on to each other's tails. And that's greed, hatred and delusion. That's what they represent, greed, hatred and delusion. So when we're very unaware and not very positive, greed, hatred and delusion is what drives us. But it's not all bad, because also in the corner of that image, there's a little path winding up and there's a person in robes going up the path. So we also have that potential for moving, well, for enlightenment as well. So at work, craving particularly is something that I think we all work with at times. So unpacking the bags and pulling things out, it's very easy to get excited when you start pulling out things that are very nice. Yeah. There's all sorts of treasures. So designer labels, better bike helmet, better toaster, silk scarves, better head massager, or a CD, DVD or book that I've wanted for a long time. So we have to work with that, but it's a good place to experience that craving and to learn to find ways to deal with it. And sometimes I see it in the customers. There's a particular look that some people have, a particular sort of feel to them, which is slightly agitated, and their eyes are kind of like, oh, and there's a kind of desperation, and it's really painful, actually, to see, like, they've got to get this thing, it's such good value, and you almost have a sense that they don't really want it, but it's just that kind of, but it's a real bargain, I've got to have it. I seem to have more than I can fit into the talk. Anyway, let's jump a bit. So I was thinking about the importance of not holding on to anything so too tightly. I very easily think of it as my business. Me and Abhay and Andy set it up. It's our business. We set it up. And I have to remember that I can't hold on to it. It's not fixed. It's not ours. It's not my business. And have to keep allowing it to change and grow. And having new team members really helps with that. Yeah, because I have to let go of my ideas and allow other people to bring in their ideas and to develop things. Yeah, it's not fixed, it's not permanent, and it's not substantial. And it's really important, I think, to remember, because we've done so well, because the business has really flourished and we've made so much money, it's really important to remember that that isn't it isn't a permanent state of affairs, that at some point it'll close, at some point it'll stop making so much money. Yeah. And I think that helps me to value it more, really, if I remember that, to value it as, you know, as it is now, and make the most of the opportunity. And then the next area is the environment. So I've already said a bit about how chaotic it can get and how important it is for us to keep it as ordered and tidy as we can. And I've also want to say a bit about inspiration, because it is a lot of the work is quite routine. So getting things out of the bag, putting the prices on them, steaming them, getting them out onto the shelves, taking stock off the shelves. It can feel very routine, And there's no end to it. It's just continuous. You know, no sooner do you put stuff out onto the shelves than you're taking stuff off and getting, sending it off to the ragman. When I'm in touch with nature, when I'm out in green spaces, I often find inspiration. Also on retreats and study, doing Dharma study, I find inspiring, and spending time communicating, so with friends in the community and at work, deeper communication. So there isn't much to say about reality for me, except that I'm trusting that if I keep really working with developing awareness and positivity, I'm setting up the conditions for coming closer to a sense of reality, coming closer to opening up to reality. So there's so much stuff coming and going, passing through the shop all the time. There's a change in customers, change in my states and the emotions and sensations, changes in my colleagues' emotional states, mental states. We buy stuff because we want it, we get it home and find we don't want it, dislike someone, and then that changes and they seem kind the next time we see them and we like them. I have to just keep letting go and letting go and letting go. I want this my way, it'll work this way. I've tried it, we've tried it before. This is the way it works. It won't work if we do it that way. It doesn't work. Let go and allow things to change. Try something different. Let go of my ideas. Say yes, let's try it. Try it wholeheartedly and just see, maybe it'll work this time, even if I think it won't. Just a continual process of letting go. And I think that's all I want to say. Thank you.